Blog Talk Radio.
The beautiful music of Francil Gowron, francil.com. Good morning, friends. It's Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. Today, a beautiful day in Boulder, Colorado, and I have my dear friend on the line and co-host, Crystalyn Beek Larson. Crystalyn, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a beautiful day here, too.
What did you say?
I said it's a beautiful day here, too.
Don't you just love fall weather? I mean, it's so crisp and just it's starting to cool off after the long, hot summer. And, oh, man, it's it reminds me of something Jesus said once in a discourse to the two brothers as they walked along to Emmaus. You know, the story of the two brothers, and Jesus appeared to them. It was one of the appearances he made after his resurrection, and he said, do you realize that this Savior that came upon you was like the shadow of a great rock in a weary land? Mm-hmm. And I think of that often, how comforting the shade of a great rock would be in a land that's exposed to the elements. And
right.
So, yeah, the coolness of the shade. For me, paradise has a lot of cool shade. And I have fair skin, so getting out of the sun is a special thing for me. Anyway, today
I hear you.
Yeah. And today we have our wonderful guests, Patricia and Thomas Strasser, with us. Are you guys there?
Yes.
We are. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, you guys. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Patricia and Thomas are so busy right now. They are, they're on an incredible spiritual journey, and they've written a very important book, and they do lectures and seminars all over the world on spiritual engineering and essentially helping people find the satisfactions of living. It's a genuine and true spirit ministry that they're engaged in, and they're engaged in it as a couple. They're devoted to this. They've, like I said, written an important book on the spiritual engineering of the same title, Spiritual Engineering, and can't stay with us the whole 2 hours, but they're going to be with us as long as they can. They got to go do some book signings today, so we honor that, and we invite you folks out there to call in and share your stories with us. We'll give them plenty of time up front, though, to tell us what they're up to, and they're going to be talking about their wonderful relationship and relationships in general, personality integration, which is a very important concept from the Arantia book. And if you do want to call in, it's the number is 646-716-8158. But I ask that you wait for a little while so we have a chance to really talk to Thomas and Patricia about what they're doing and about relationships, satisfying romantic relationships. So I don't want to hog this. Chrislyn, do you have something you want to say too?
Well, just that this is one of those topics I think that we could have, that we could easily run on for several weeks because it's of so much interest to so many. I would like to just ask you right off the bat, what do you think are the really most important things that people need to take into consideration when deciding to commit to a long-term relationship?
Well, that's such an incredible question because life is about relationships. We cannot survive without having encounters. It could be very minimal encounters or profound encounters with people. But this new approach to relationships from the spiritual engineering standpoint, it just kind of established a new model, a new paradigm for relationships. And we're talking about three different kind of relationships. The building rock is the spiritual relationship. The second relationship, the most important part, is the relationship with self and then the relationship with others. And relationships don't happen. We need to build them. And in that order, a spiritual relationship, healthy relationship with self, and then relationship with others.
You know, I'd like to add something to that. And this is so interesting because over 20-some years ago, this is what started me out because I was going through a relationship that ended in divorce, and I wanted to find out how to have really good relationships and be happy in life. And basically, that's what ended up as spiritual engineering, and a lot of it came from the Urantia book. And one of the things that the first night that Patricia and I met, we met at a spiritual retreat at Urantia, of course, in Nestes Park. And the very first night, I mean, I knew that we had something going, something could be very special. And I still remember that first night I told her that if we could build this the way and have this extraordinary relationship, she would always be third with me. And I needed always to be third with her, that you know, my relationship with God had to be the most important. My relationship with myself, my dignity and self-respect, integrity, I couldn't give that up for her, but she would be the most important person on the planet. And if she could make me that and we could try to build a relationship like that, it could be something beyond her wildest dreams, and that's the way it's turned out.
And you know, that's something very interesting because usually when people go into the relationships or looking for a relationship, they just looking for someone to validate them, to make them feel good about themselves. And, of course, when he told me that, I was like, I never heard that before. You know, what is he talking about, that I'm going to be the third person? But then I asked him back, I say, so can I do the same? And he say, of course. And that was really for us was the beginning of this relationship that is based on that self-respect, right to privacy, right to make our own decisions, right to nurture our own spirituality together and in partnership, right to work in our minds, to take that honest look in ourselves and each other, and then we can give that healthy self-love to each one of us. We can build on that because we had a building rock, that healthy relationship with self, which is loving, is compassionate. We cut ourselves a lot of slack, but also we are very honest with ourselves.
I like what you had to say about sort of the rights that you maintain even when you're in a primary relationship or committed relationship or, let's say, a marriage. You said you still have the right to privacy and self-expression, and that there's a certain sense of integrity that you have to maintain in your to your own values and to your ideals as well as to your spiritual commitment. I'm assuming that's what you mean, your like your spiritual commitment to God. And I recall that you have a section in your book that is titled Impaired Integrity. Can you talk a little bit about what that means to you?
Yeah, one of the things that I got to watch phones here. I had a phone that had a battery, not a good battery. I apologize for that.
One of the things that Tom refers to impaired integrity in the book is when we go into that relationship, in another relationship with other person, feeling or looking for that person to fill that void that we have, to make us feel good about ourselves, to make us like ourselves, kind of give us that direction that only and only comes from that spiritual relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And he can expand a little bit more on that, but that's the basic concept about that impaired integrity.
You know, Crystal and Paula, when I first started this, I said I wanted to have good relationships, find out the key to it. And I'm an engineer, so I went out and did a tremendous amount of research on what made the extraordinary relationships. And in doing that, I looked at psychology, William James, Carl Jung, Abraham Maslow, and at Robert Ellis and a bunch of different people, what really made these great relationships. And it was kind of astounding because I found out that, and I've shared this before, that people know that 48% of our marriages are premier relationship, and 48% end in divorce. But what people don't realize is 67% of the second ones and 73% of the third ones also fail. And that was just kind of eye-opening, so I had to find out how to do this. And the key part of it, one of the key things that come out, is this idea of integrity. And that, integrity has a couple different meanings, and adherence to a set of values or principles. But in every dictionary, the real meaning comes from the root word integer, which means the quality or condition of being whole and complete, unimpaired, undivided. And I found out that for me, I either was whole or I had a hole. I had this void inside of me that I wanted to fill. I tried to fill it with money and possessions and chemicals and relationships and tried everything, and nothing worked. And I had to get to where I had integrity, where I was okay by myself, where I didn't form a relationship on the basis of need. And that's what I explained to Patricia, that she can add to my happiness, and she does tremendously, but she can't create it. I have to go into a relationship. When I can go into a relationship and be okay with me, then the other relationships with other people just fall into place. And then I realized that Jesus had been telling this over 2,000 years ago when he said, love your neighbor as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And he's telling me that I'm only capable of giving or receiving love in direct proportion to how much I have a healthy self-love, not an egotistical love, but where I'm really okay with me, then I can develop relationships, and I can get all these things, the money, the possessions, but they're not the core driving value, and they're added on. And it takes the power of other people away from. They're not forming my feelings. They're not pushing my buttons, we call it. So this integrity is just a key part, and this integrity comes, and again, after years of research, from what the Urantia book calls this personality unification, and that's the key to integrity, is not just saying the words or understanding the concept of personality unification. But what the spiritual engineering does is give us very step-by-step practical tools on how to achieve that, progressively how to achieve that.
Now, going back to that concept of impaired integrity is when we're trying to fill that void with those material things of with those defects of character that we have, or when we don't have that relationship, that spiritual relationship. So when the integrity is impaired, so we cannot achieve that personality unification, which is really a gift from the Father.
Maybe you can be more specific, though, about what you mean by personality integration, because many of our listeners might be unfamiliar with that term or that phrase, and it sounds like it's something that could be a very broad topic. Do you feel you have a way to simplify that concept for our listeners?
Yeah, and it comes, again, the Urantia book talks about this in a number of different places. And one thing it says, the purpose of cosmic, listen to this, the purpose of cosmic evolution is to achieve unity of personality through increasing spiritual dominance, volitional response to the teaching and leading of the thought adjuster. And then on the section on personality survival and the section on psychic circles, it always talks about how we have physical, mental, and spiritual, I call them life arenas, but each one has a function. It's not a matter of balancing those. It's a matter of letting them perform their function. The physical part of us, our environment, our bodies and everything, our physical desires are supposed to be subordinate to everything else. Our mind, that wonderful mind that we've been given to use, is meant to coordinate between the spiritual and the physical. And then our inner spiritual guide is meant to give us direction. But it's how to achieve spirit dominance of our mind and our whole personality. And, again, it talks about that in many different sections. But what I had to do, again, as an engineer, I mean, it's great to be told that, but how do you do it? How do you leave... How do you do this on a daily basis? And I can commit to do it. I can say, oh, I want to do this, but how do I do it? What's the step-by-step tools that help me do this progressively? Because even if I want to, I can't always do it. And for me anyway, it's a very progressive experience on how to let my mind be dominated by that inner guide. The section on the mind arena of choice talks about this, that you know, our inner guide, that thought adjuster, our spiritual guide, is meant to give us direction. We are the captain. We're the pilot. Our self-will makes the decisions. But we have to decide and then find a way to do it, to let our spirit be the guiding factor, our purpose, and give us the goals and the values and the check thing in life to let us make sure we're doing the right thing.
And the problem becomes in our life when we go in the opposite direction, when we are so entangled into our daily basic material physical decisions that they become the dominant part in our life. So we're going totally on self-will. And when we're going on self-will, totally disconnected from that spiritual part, so that's when we create more problems for ourselves, and then the mind gets filled with all those emotions that come in from making those wrong decisions, and then we become preoccupied, we become anxious, we become worried, fearful, and in that kind of a state of mind, we cannot perceive, we cannot be spiritually directed by our thought adjusters. So when we talk about a spiritual alignment, that's what we're referring to, that the spiritual part of us, that spiritual relationship, it should be the building rock, the foundation, and it's like building a house. We put the foundation. We build that relationship with God, with a thought adjuster, through commitment, through discipline, through actions. Very specific, concrete actions. You know, I want to build a relationship with you, Paula, or with my husband, with a friend. You know, I want to be a friend with someone that I met. I have to spend time with that person. It's not just offering lip service. So when I say I need to put time into relationship, what it's telling me is just I have to invest time and I have to make time. And this is what one of the elements of spiritual engineering. It tells us how to spend that time in each one of the relationships. How do we spend time with God? How do we build that relationship? And then how do we spend time with ourselves? How do we build a healthy relationship? So it is a very specific step-by-step process that allows us to build those three relationships, starting from the foundation, the spiritual, then the healthy relationship with myself, and then when we have those two elements in place, the foundation and the world, so I can go and have good relationship with other people. That's what we call sort of like integration, unification in our relationships.
So integration would be the whole being operating mm-hmm. in unison. All
Correct.
Things are lined up,
right.
Body, mind, spirit, everything functioning with integrity and you know, moving in a direction that's, you know, integral and mm-hmm. and has integrity. But somebody said something on the board that I want to ask you guys, because I've heard, this is the second time I've heard this from somebody, and it really intrigues me. He's an incredible young man, very handsome young man, and he said he's looking for the right person, but he's having a hard time. And he made this comment, I find it hard to know someone's true motivations. He's the second man, he's the second man that has said this to me,
mm-hmm.
and it really strikes me. I find it hard to know, you know, and the Arantia book tells us very clearly that in order to fall in love with somebody, we have to know, we have to come to know their truths, their sentiments and motives. Or motivation.
Right.
And so what do you guys think of that? What, you know, I can sympathize with this somewhat, because it is hard sometimes to know people's true motivations. And he later said on the board, he doesn't, you know, he feels like people aren't always honest about what their true motivations are, and maybe they don't even think about it much. Maybe they
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Thomas.
That is excellent, because that is one of the things that we work so much with motives, and one of the things that I've learned for me, and because you'll find in the spiritual engineering, when we look at this self relationship, one of the things that we really examine and have a process to examine is our own motivation. Why, and how we fought, and exactly what this young man's saying, I found myself having patterns of motive that I had picked up from my youth and kept going, and a lot of these were unconscious. I didn't even know I had them. So it took a very detailed look at myself to uncover these motives, my real underlying motives. And the reason I'm saying that, Paul, when I learned to look at my own and discern the symptoms on my motives and some of the telltale signs of my motives, I can see those in other people more clearly. So one of the things that when I really look at my own motivation, you'd asked the question, or Crystalline had before, you know, about we focus so much on this self-relationship because that's the key to the relationships with other people. But, you know, we were able to combine completely different cultures and a lot of different beliefs and different ideas into something that has basically working toward a unified relationship. And in the book, I talk about what we look at, because I go through my own experiences of where I had a really bad relationship. Then I had one that was pretty good that I thought was great. And now I've got that fantastic one. And the difference is there's six things I need to look for in evaluating this. We should share similar core values. That's one. We should have some degree of physical, mental, and spiritual and emotional compatibility. We should have a loving tolerance and respect for differences. We should be able to try this out in that initial phase of the relationship and have a lot of tolerance and respect for differences. But one of the key things we need is have or be willing to find a process that helps us build these relationships on this basis we're talking about, the natural order, and lets each person grow individually and builds and nurtures a union. That process has to include all of that. And then we have to commit to actively and continuously work on that process. And one of the main things is we have to commit to the idea that being happy is more important than being right. And so those are six things I found that really make a difference when I'm looking at somebody. But he's right. When I start talking core values and things, I can try to find that person's motivation. And even then, I run the risk of being misled. But that's the difference between making a mistake based on information and the data than just making a mistake based on it's what I want it to be. And I will still make mistakes, but the mistakes will not be as long-lasting or they won't be as much in-depth if I make a mistake when I have this kind of objective evaluation. Does that make any sense?
Well, absolutely. You know, I think that, and this is key, knowing your own motivations.
That's it, yeah.
Isn't one of the great philosophies of all times just simply know thyself?
Yes.
And I think that it's what you were saying early on too. When you know your own motivations and you know what makes you tick, then you can forgive yourself for the times that you've really screwed up in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And when you can forgive yourself for that, you can forgive others for it.
Absolutely.
And for me, you know, oftentimes I will do a little exercise that when I catch myself being set off, like something bothered me, and I can do this with physical illness as well. If I don't feel good, if I'm, like, sick to my stomach or something. When something happens that sets me off, I will go back in my mind, and it's like my own personal kinesiology resistance test. I'll go back and I'll say, okay, what set me off? What did this? And I'll say, was it that? No. Was it that? No, that didn't really bother me. Was it that? Bingo.
Yep.
I get a visceral reaction when I hit on the thing that really bugged me. And when I identify that thing, then I can start asking myself a series of questions like, now, why did that bother you so bad? What was it about that really touched your, you know, pressed your button? I have a friend, Rabia Harris, who calls it your sacred wound. Lots of times people do something that just pushes on a sacred wound, and man, watch out when that happens, you know. And I think so many times when you're talking about getting to know yourself and your own motivations, it hurts too bad to even go there. You won't even let yourself go there. But then you're doomed.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Thomas.
That's why we have the spiritual relationship as the foundation. We can't go there without this help from this inner spiritual power. And, you know, in page 1738, I love that, because Jesus talks about the expulsive power, he used that word, of a spiritual transformation. I mean, that is such the expulsive power of a spiritual transformation can overcome anything. And I can't take this honest, in-depth look at myself without that foundation.
Because it is such a terrifying experience. Being able to look at our mistakes, the things that we could have done better, recognize that we still are part animals and we came from there, it is terrifying if we don't see the other part. We are divine in origin. And if we don't have that to balance, that look at ourselves, that honest look at ourselves, it's going to be very terrifying. So that's why it's so important to build that spiritual relationship, that to get to know that living God that really dwells inside each one of us. Because when we have that certainty, when we feel that presence, we are able to go to those dark neighborhoods in our mind and those memories. No one of us is perfect. We have made terrible mistakes, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult, and I'm talking from my own experience. Thank God through life I have been able to better myself with the knowledge of the Urantia book and knowing that my destiny is divine. But I had made very serious mistakes in my life. And sometimes if I look back at them, I'm like, wow, what happened to me? I was another person. Yes, sure, I was another person. But if I wouldn't have this knowledge that really a fragment of God dwells in my mind, I will feel like an orphan. I will feel that I don't have the resources, the strength to go through that period of my life and look back. Even what is happening right now in the world, having that certainty that there is a loving God that really lives inside each one of us, it gives us that peace of mind, that strength, that courage that we need to face day by day.
You know, Paula, you said something so insightful there. And it's something that, again, back to spiritual engineering, that when I have, and one of the core beliefs of this is that whenever I'm upset, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. And back to what Patricia was saying about, we look at this building relationships with other people as building the house. You know, the spiritual is the foundation, our self-relationship are the walls, and then the roof is the crowning achievement, our relationships with other people. But what I've found is that when I am upset, when something happens, the symptom, the feeling originates in relationships with other people. The solution, the problem, first of all, lies in the self-relationship. My perceptions, my expectations, my motives, my history, something is causing me to react that way. And then if I can solve it there with my mind, I'm fine. But the solution always lies in that spiritual relationship if I can't work through it myself. So it's real, and when you picture that house, the foundation, the walls, and the roof, and just picture the symptom, the feeling, the unsettledness, the discontent always is related to that other person, some other person or something outside ourselves. The problem is our inside ourselves and our reaction, and the solution, if we can't do it with our tools that we have, is always on that spiritual relationship. But that idea of looking at ourselves to see why we're reacting is something very few people develop. And I had a hard time, and that's why in the book there's a step-by-step procedure to do that, because it's something that, it's one thing, again, it's one thing to say it, but you have developed the technique solely on your own, and so few people have that technique or have that understanding that when I'm upset, I need to look at me and not what's going on out there.
I'm going
Can
back
you give
to
us
that
some
quick.
Of those practical steps? Let's just walk us through a few of them. Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, when we start this, we go through this self-appraisal for ourselves and identify what our patterns are. What has caused us to get angry? What has caused me to feel guilty? What has caused me to feel isolated or lonely? And we go back through our history and look at the times in our life when we've done this. And so as we go through this, we recognize these patterns that when people do this, I react this way. When people do this, when I feel angry, it's because. So we look at our past history, and then that carries forward into, it's very easy to recognize once we have that established as we go forward, you know, when I can slow down enough and look at it, it's purely coming from one of those patterns. And again, back to what Paula said, we have a very specific step-by-step procedure on a nightly review, we call it. I go over my day at night. Okay, where did I react? Okay, I got angry today. Why did I do that? Not in the moment it's going on, but at night when it's calm, when I go to bed, I look at myself and say, okay, how did I do today? Okay, I messed this up. I screwed this up. I should have done better here. But it's a ongoing evaluation of where we are today and why we're reacting. And one of the biggest things that's helped me is that when I'm reacting, if I can remember that when I'm upset, I'm wrong. Point out, flat out, period. I have to look. It may be, and that doesn't mean I have to accept unacceptable behavior. It means I have to change the way I react to it. So my emotions are my barometer. When I react or feel, you know, guilty or somebody pushes my buttons and makes me angry or hurts my feelings, I can try to almost get automatic to where I step back and say it's not what's going on, it's what's there. And sometimes in the moment, I can't back up enough to really accept that or believe it, but it keeps me from reacting. And then when I go through that nightly review, it's generally one of my old patterns kicking in, you know, insecurity or this integrity, a problem with my integrity, or some, and but it's very specific step-by-step things that we do to look at ourselves and evaluate why we're reacting that way. And it sounds like Paula is getting, has got this in place, and it's just fantastic.
Well, you know, my father, when I was a little kid, said probably one of the most important things, and I know it was a spiritual moment because I don't think I would have remembered this all these years. But he was a very wise man, and he was a policeman, and so he had to deal with people who are just absolutely oftentimes just raw, acting out, acting from a place that is so base, so wounded, and doing such horrible things to each other. And he had to deal with domestic violence and the worst in humanity, and often, you know, in my experience, it developed wisdom in him, and it developed an understanding of humanity and the human condition in him. And he was a loving and compassionate man anyway, so he couldn't help but go there. And he said to me, Paula, he said, I was about 8 years old, he said, always give a person the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they may, prove that they're not trustworthy or prove that they're wrong, but always give them the benefit of the doubt until they prove that they can't be trusted. And I think what happened for me was I started to incorporate that so early in my life, that basic trust in human beings that they want that. You know, that they are basically good, and that's my experience, certainly, but it developed in me a willingness to give myself the same benefit of the doubt. So when I've acted up, I don't immediately think bad of myself, and of course that was reinforced by the way that my father and mother dealt with me. They didn't, you know, they never dealt in definitives like, you're such a bad person, or, you know, they didn't put a lot of negatives on me ever, and so that helped certainly. But I'm able to say to myself in a healthy way, so why did you do that? There's got to be a reason. That what motivated that? And I give myself the benefit of the doubt. I don't immediately just go believe the worst about myself.
And that seems also a great way to deal with other people too. Is when someone has done something that you don't understand or that you find pushes your buttons, and you ask them, why did you do that? Why, not why did you do that, like it's an accusational question, but a sincere question, and a sincere question that is really looking for an authentic answer.
I would like to link this part of the conversation with what we were talking about 10 minutes ago, and in regards to the question of these young, handsome men, which is, how do you know a person's motives? Just talking about choosing that person, and I need to have clarity of what is it, why do I need to have a partnership? It begins there. Why do I need to have a partnership, a partner? And it goes, again, with my motives. Now, if my motives are wrong, perhaps I'm going to attract or get into a relationship with a person which maybe their motives are not clear. And it's up to me, as to use my wisdom, the wisdom of the experience. Because in some moment in time, I got to say, okay, this person, oh, it's a good person, but this person continuously lying to me. So do I still give them the benefit of the doubt? They doing this. And to me, it's very clear because lately I've been dealing with a lot of situations where, people are basically essentially good, and then sometimes they come from those wounded places. But talking about the healthy self-love, do I put myself in that predicament, in that situation when I'm going to be hurt? Or can I make a healthy decision and say, I will not participate into this lie anymore? And for me, that is a clear indication of how I am in regards to other people, how I am in relationships, what kind of friends or people I attracting, or I'm building relationships with. So it's very important to have, for me anyway, to have clarity of my motives. Where am I going? What am I expecting? And where I'm able to participate? Yes, because people basically we are essentially good, but we have so much growth to do, and we make mistakes. And if someone is lying or taking advantage of me in a relationship, in my family, I think that it's my honor and my right to say, I'm not going to participate into this relationship because it's not healthy for me.
You know, what you mentioned and what Paul was mentioning and some of what Christy is talking about, again, I'm an engineer, so I have to look at what is the process, what's the step-by-step procedure. And what Paul said and you said, and one of the things in the book, and I had to do, is realize the difference in my own life and other people between mistakes and patterns. Everybody makes mistakes. I make them. But a pattern is when it happens repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And though I've said I'm going to change it and I've committed to change, but I still do the same thing. And I can forgive almost any mistake, but I have to be very careful of a pattern in a relationship and a pattern in my own life. And I found that when I go through and look at my own patterns, and again, it helps me realize this idea between patterns and mistakes in my relationships with other people. Everybody's going to make mistakes, but when it becomes a pattern in that relationship, I have to make the decision, is that going to interfere with my own integrity? Is that going to violate my core values and principles, or is it something I can accept? But that idea between mistakes and patterns is just crucial for me in my own self, in my self-relationship, and relationships with other people. And that's kind of what Paula was alluding to. You know, everybody's going to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make them.
Mm-hmm. But when someone in a relationship, sometimes we compromise our own principles and values because we want that relationship so bad, because we feel so lonely, because we want to have that boyfriend or we want to have that girlfriend, we want to be in that marriage, that we want that so bad, and that reflects lack of integrity, impaired integrity.
Right.
I'm not happy with myself, so I need my friends to accept me. I need this person to validate me. And in order for me to have that relationship, I compromise my values. I take things that under other circumstances I will not put up with. Why? Because I feel of rejection, or I feel of I'm afraid of spending a few hours by myself. I'm afraid of not having anybody to go out on Saturday night. So I put up with those kind of behaviors because I'm not comfortable with myself.
That's a really good point, I think, and one that I know that people experience on a regular basis, is that sense that if you set boundaries or if you don't accept certain behaviors from your mate or from your friends or from the people you're close with, that you're risking a permanent relationship. You're risking losing that person as a friend or especially as a mate. How do you approach that with people, people who are really genuinely locked up when it comes to fear of being alone?
Well, that's what I say. I have to, and that's why this self-relationship is so crucial. I have to get to where I'm okay with me, and then these other relationships add to it, and then I can look, again, back to that mistakes and patterns. If it's a pattern, is it one that I have to give up my integrity? Do I have to sacrifice my dignity, my self-respect for this? And then I have to make that decision. Is it worth it? Is it, you know, and there are some patterns I might find acceptable that it's worth the value of the relationship is worth accepting that. There's others I may not, but I have to make a conscious decision and be very aware of what the price of that is. And again, for me, and that's what's in the book, is step-by-step tools on how to do this, because that's where I found myself in my first relationship, my first marriage. I just gave up everything trying to keep that relationship. I sold myself. I mean, it was really eye-opening when I was able to step back and take a look about it. I gave up everything. In the second relationship, I gave up some things. But it's the idea of how to be able to be okay with ourselves. And just, you know, Chris, a quick one here is that, I lost my second wife due to cancer, and I took care of her and everything. And after that, I'd never been alone in my life without a woman in my life. And I thought, well, you know, I need a woman. And I started out down that path, and then I realized what I'd learned in spiritual engineering. And I said, no, and I really worked on my relationship with God and my relationship with myself. And I actually got to the point that I knew I could be okay, I could be good by myself. I could be just fine by myself if I didn't have a woman or another person in my life. I could have good close friends, intimate relations, but not that other special person. Within a month after I got to that point, I met Patricia. And it was just, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's like the soil being tilled.
Uh-huh.
It's like the soil being tilled and being made ready for the seed that's going to grow deep and send down deep roots, and that one's really going to take, because you've tilled that soil to the point now where it's really ready to receive that blessing. And I just want to add too, Patricia, I hear what you are saying about creating boundaries. And I think in my experience as well, some people are at a place in their life where they are just so toxic in themselves,
yes,
that they are poisoning everybody around them.
Yes.
And God bless them, they can't help it, but you know, there are spirit poisons like fear and doubt and you know, shame and blame and all of these things that just, you know, can make us so toxic as a human being and just put our own spiritual life into such turmoil if we have to deal with that on a regular basis. And we all do. You know, whether it be somebody at work or a child that's going through, you know, their terrible teens, or, you know, and you have to deal with that. But sometimes you have to draw boundaries too, and you have to say, you know what, I'm not going to take any more of that. I'm not going to take it because I don't have to. And because you've got to figure this out, you are, you know, sometimes you just have to give it squarely back to them and say, you know what, you've got to deal with this and you've got to work it out, or you are going to chase every good thing out of your life. And, you know, it's important to draw boundaries. It really is. You know, Jesus said, get behind me. You know, mm-hmm. It was his way of saying, get out of my face with that.
Mm-hmm.
You won't tempt me with that.
And we have to be so clear about that. And just the Urantia book refers to those like a mental poison. And it even says, goes further on saying that the angels, sometimes they don't look when we are overreacting, or when they can't even understand why we are so consumed by fear. Imagine that. Even the angels, they don't understand. So it is a mental poison. And if we have this healthy self-love, we'll be able to recognize when a relationship is toxic for us and say, well, I may have to go alone by myself for a period of time, but I'm not going to put myself in that situation where I will lose my integrity, because at the end I will lose everything, my principles, even my relationship, my spiritual relationship. How many people that I know, they have a decent relationship with God, and then they go and run into the wrong partner. A partner that, let's say, is not interested in building a spiritual relationship, they start changing their priorities. And after a few months, these people are totally drained. They don't have that spiritual connection, and they feel like all their life has been consumed by that relationship. That's why we're going back to the basics. The spiritual relationship is fundamental. And you know, when I met Tom, I wasn't looking for a relationship. And I thought in the beginning of in our marriage that the worst thing that it could happen to me was if for any reason I would lose him. And right now, in this moment in my life, I can look at that possibility, that the most horrible thing can happen to me, losing my husband, losing my family, losing my daughter, losing everything in my life. But I know, and I'm certain, if I have my relationship with God, I'll be all right. I'll be absolutely all right.
Now, assuming that you have gotten to the place in your life where you are fairly self-confident, or you have a sense of self-respect, and that is your foundational reaction, place of reaction, how do you go forward then from there into facilitating the type of healthy relationship you want with another person?
That is a great question, because when I had a place where I know that it's a living God working in my life, is helping me to take that honest look at myself and become a better person, something incredible happened. It's not just about me. I lose importance. I start being the center of my universe. And who becomes the center? The other people. So I can go and use all that new release energy into service, committing to helping other people, to show them and to share what I found, to reveal to them all this incredible and loving God that is the Father of all. And I reveal that through my actions. I don't have hidden agendas. I don't want to manipulate. I try to be transparent in my relationships. When I'm in contact with a person, I'm trying to look for what is good for that person, not just what is good for me. See, instead of becoming so self-centered, I become other-centered. I let go of myself, and I become more interested in other people. And if I'm going to look for a relationship, which I'm not, because I'll have an extraordinary relationship, romantic relationship, I will really ask myself, from the listeners out there, why do I need a partner in my life? Why? Why this person is supposed to bring into my life that I don't have? Are my motives real? Will having a relationship will contribute to the development of my soul? It is good for me. It is good for my family. Do those kind of things. Something that I teach people when I work with these healthy, building healthy relationships is, really, when you're looking for a partner, you have the right to screen this person. Screen this person. Ask as many questions as you can. Find out about their families. Find out where they're coming from. Find out what is the vision, their purpose in life. Find out if they really have a plan for their life, and you concur to those plans. Find out if spirituality is important in their lives. Find out how much money they wanted to make, how many children they want to have, how they want to spend their free time. All those questions are important. But what happens is we start dating, we start going out with a person, and because we are so infatuated with the person, we don't take the time to get to know where the real values that this person has, and then their values become our values. And in the process, we sacrifice ourselves, we compromise our principles, and we become we start believing and living another person's lives instead of living for ourselves. And if that person leaves us, what happens? We are left with anything.
You know, another thing, Kristen, what you're saying is one of the things I've learned in the hard way is that if I want to leave myself open to have this type of relationship, if I'm okay with me and I get to that point and I'm open to this, I'm not looking for it, but I'm open, you know, I don't go into a briar patch to pick the tomatoes. I go into a garden. And so I look and I make myself open in areas where I'm going, my likelihood of running into somebody like that is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a very small chance of finding a highly spiritual poor person at midnight on Friday night in a bar. Okay, so I try to put myself in the position of where I can run into those people and try a lot of different places and a lot of different things. But one of the biggest things, and I think what Patricia mentioned, is when I start talking to these people, find out, okay, what do you believe about God? Okay, and they don't have to believe the same thing, but is God important to you? Is your spirit, what do you believe about commitment? What do you believe about personal responsibility? How do you feel about these things? And get into these kind of conversations and see if it's comfortable with you.
You know, and you brought up such a good point, too, both of you, about knowing people. What are some of the red flags that you should look for?
What a question. That's,
you know, I mean, now people, we know there are people out there that will tell you anything they think you want to hear. And getting to know somebody is not just asking them questions and getting their answers, but it's also, there's something else to it than more than that. And as we all know, I mean, oftentimes, you know, you travel with somebody, you really get to know them. You live with them for a while, you really get to know them now. But with a partner, you don't want to get to know a person really when you live with them, because you might find something you really don't want to know about that person. And now that you're living with them, it's going to be really hard to get out of that relationship. It's going to be painful and maybe even violent. Who knows? What are some of the red flags that you know?
The reason we laughed is that was one of my terms, you know, when we met and everything. And I told, you know, that is the exact term that I used, that we needed to look for each other's red flags, you know. And that's been years ago, and we still use that term. That's why we're both laughing here. And it is. And one of the things, and again, back, and I've worked through this, and it's in the book, part of it, is that I have to be careful how I extend trust.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't automatically, when I first meet somebody, give them trust until I know they're trustworthy. I trust them with certain things, but then my trust and my ideas are based on what people do, not on what they say. And that is a key point, is in any relationship, I believe what people do more than what they say, because people can tell you anything. And so I extend trust and develop this relationship on a more intimate basis with experience, and all the time being aware of, if these red flags come up that are in my area of my core values, I better step back and take a look. Now, if it's a red flag, somebody, you know, it doesn't put the toothpaste away and I want it to be arranged in a certain way, I have to be able to put that on how important is it. How important is it really? But if what I look for do these red flags, based on experience, not on what people say, based on what I see in their actions, does it go against something I really believe that's very important to me? And what you're saying, Paul, is just so – I had a tendency, and I wanted to run out and believe what people said and run out and trust, and I've had to really back up from that. I've had to learn, and this is the way my relationship with God worked. I learned to trust God based on experience. I started into that with the want to, with the desire, but I really learned to trust God based on experience, and I learned to trust other people the same way. the more intimate and more close I get with that relationship, the more vulnerable I become, the more I extend myself out. But I do that, try to do that, based on experience other than want to or desire.
How do you feel about sort of deciding that you can risk pain? You can risk, let's say, rejection or facing a truth being reflected back to you from someone else where it might be a very painful topic to discuss or something you don't, something where you have been successfully denying that particular reality in your own character and someone else brings it out in you. I mean, there is a certain risk involved in facing our, I guess you could call them our inner demons.
There is, and that's why, again, back to the way this process of spiritual engineering develops, it has, I mean, at the end of this book, there's a 20-some page appraisal that lets us go through and look at that and makes us look at that in detail ourselves. And then we, as we become aware of that, then we're not, you know, we're much more, we're not as likely to hear it back from another person. We're aware of it ourselves. And when I am in that relationship, there's still going to be times like you're saying. And the thing is that I really have to accept the fact that, and one of the other things is that there's a difference between pain and misery. And I'm going to have pain in life. I'm going to have grief. I'm going to mourn. I'm going to be disappointed with myself and with other people. But when I'm okay with myself and I'm okay with God, that becomes much easier to accept. I'm not as vulnerable. Being okay with having a strong spiritual relationship and knowing, realizing that I'm human, I'm going to make mistakes, and this might be a mistake that I need to be aware of, makes me much less vulnerable to fall into that area of misery. I look at it as it's pain, it's something that I need to look at and accept. And this happened to me with Patricia about 3 or 4 years ago. I have been doing this for years. And 3 or 4 years ago, I was doing something, I went through something, and she said, you know, I'd be a little self-righteous there. And I thought, oh, me? No, I'm not, no way. And I started looking at that, and my gosh, it opened up a whole new area of my life that I had a tremendous amount of improvement to work on, was this being self-righteous. And that, again, that came out of our conversations, but being willing to accept that as a constructive thing. And she didn't say it in a real critical way. She just mentioned it, but it really flagged me that I need to look at it. And boy, when I did, it opened up something completely new, a whole new area of my life I needed improvement.
Just when you thought you were perfect.
No, I didn't think that, but I didn't think this was a problem because I justified it. My mind had justified, and I had been doing this for years and hadn't realized how much varying degrees of self-righteousness let me discount what other people said or discount other people's input.
Right.
You know, and there's...
Well, reminds me of something a friend of mine said not too long ago in one of her workshops. It's like... and just in case you really think that you are done, you know, growing, that you have mastered everything there is to master in your own spiritual growth, and if you're wondering about what you need to work on next, just ask your family and your friends. You know, am I done
Ellen,
growing?
And, but also,
am
Crystal,
I perfect yet?
You can ask your family and friends, but you have to be sure that the people you're asking you feel safe with. You
right.
feel safe with that they're not going to cut you to the quick just to cut you, you know? And we all know that there's people in our own families that would do that.
Right,
you know?
That's true.
And that's the other part of having a satisfying relationship.
Paul, that gets back to what I was saying about learning to extend trust based on evidence, not on what I want. And I learned to extend this trust and ask the questions of the people that have proven trustworthy. Not because I want them to be, but I have the experience and the data and the information that their actions, not their words, their actions have shown them to be trustworthy.
And
I have a friend that I'm thinking of right now who for many years would bring to me
sort of a litany of things that were being said against me. And it would be couched or disguised as her concern for me. Like, you know, wanting me to know who I can trust and who's on my team and who's really just out there beating me up. Well, giving her the benefit of the doubt and believing that she was really trying to help me, she was really a friend who was, in fact, interested in my highest good or my well-being, I would listen to what she told me and then would sort of evaluate it. And after a few years, it became clear to me that she was the person who was saying those things about me. She was the one who was sort of going behind my back and undermining me. And that in her coming to me and telling me these things, it was an additional tool in her bag for how to try to shake my sense of self-confidence or my inner stability. And I think that one of the things that I notice about my husband, my current significant other, is that he almost never does things like that. Just his intention is almost never to undermine me. And that's a wonderful way for me to determine, you know, who are the people I really need to listen to when they bring me information about something that isn't working in my life. You know, is this someone who's always been on my team before? And if so, then even if it's a really painful trait or event or example that they're bringing to my attention, then it's worth my taking the risk. It's worth my listening to something that might be really painful, because I really would rather know the truth, even if it hurts me, than just have placating lies that comfort me.
Our good friend says, I'd rather be disillusioned than illusioned any day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But again, and what Crystal's saying is exactly what I'm saying. It's based on experience. It's based on a person proving their trustworthiness, their care for you, their love, instead of just saying that. That is so many people. And the reason I recognize it, because it's one of my problems, they do something or they believe so much what people say instead of looking at the actions, how they really act. And then over and over get hurt by people. And it's so important to look at how these people, how do they act in their own lives? What's the history of them? You know, what's their history with me?
Right. And you know, let's face it. You know, there are people we can help professionally sometimes and people we can't. And there are people we can live with and bring into our inner circle and have a daily and allow them to have a daily influence on our lives. And there are people that we can't do that with.
Right.
And, you know, for whatever reason, you just have to, you know, the master, Jesus, was the master of discernment.
That discernment, yes.
And he didn't, you know, one of the most intriguing things about that they say about him is he never followed up on people.
Now, that is a fascinating thing to look at. I mean, one you very rarely hear that comment. But tell me more about that, Paula.
Well, it fascinates me. I'd love to hear, you know, what Thomas and Patricia think. Is Patricia still with us, Thomas?
No, she had to leave. She had to get to her book signing.
Okay, so what do you think of that? He never followed up on people. Now, it may be something that was unique to him because he didn't have to. You know, he's the creator of the universe. He knows that he has his angels and other agencies that are going to be right there with him, taking care of him, and he doesn't have to follow up on them.
You know, that's interesting. No, because that's one of the things, really. I don't follow up with people unless I'm concerned about their personal safety or something.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is there's people I have called or something, and people I one guy that was having some problems here, I took him out camping for a weekend. I still follow up with him because he was in a very precarious place. But most of the people, what we've got, it has been a gift. It's nothing. I mean, I was talking to Paula before the thing. I know where I came from. I came from the bottom of the barrel. I mean, I've done things that, were just not great things in life, really horrible. And so anything I've got comes to me by the grace of God. And just something real quick. I've used that term so often. I actually went back and looked it up in the dictionary international I've got. Grace means an unmerited or unearned gift. Unmerited or unearned gift is what it means. And I've got so much I give to that. But I give it, and I try to help people, but it's not up to me what they do with it in their lives. If they want to come back and ask questions, that's great. But it's not up to me to see that they change. I can hardly take care of myself some days. So I really don't. Now, if it's in a personal, again, in that intimate relationship or a very close relationship, it's a little bit different because, and one of the things that we've learned is that we can give, you know, people can ask us, what can I do about this problem? What can I do? You know, I have a problem with anger. And we can give them the tools, and the tools absolutely work, but they choose not to use them, or they choose them to use them sporadically. And if it's in that close relationship, it affects me more than it does if it's in just somebody that's a friend or acquaintance, something like that. And I have to be, you know, very aware of how I react to that. I've got to check my reactions to that.
Yeah, it reminds me of the, the parable. Jesus gave the parable of the woman who had lost a coin, and she was cleaning up and found it in the dust, and went out and celebrated. And for me, that parable is about the inner life and about inner work, the inner work we have to do and what we've been talking about, really, getting right within ourselves. And that's not easy work.
No.
You know, you really have to want to do it. You really have to want to get right within yourself. You can give people tools and how to do this. But, you know, they have to be willing to do the work because it
is. Exactly. And that's so important. And they have to do the work. And I think it's not something like taking a college test where you study for it, do it, and it's over. It is an ongoing process that has to be done. It's a continuous progression because I'm always. And one of the things that is so interesting that I found with me, and I spend 25, 30 years, you know, I have a list of my character problems I went through back in 1981 or 82, and I wrote them down. I went over this with a really nice priest and everything. We sat and talked, and I wrote these down. And it's real interesting. Doing this for 20-some years, I never invent another new problem. I never go take somebody else's, tendencies. I always just find different ways to use my own. So when I become aware of them, those things are patterns in my life that always come back and resurface. They're camouflaged sometimes, but they're always the same root problems I had 20-some years ago, just finding a different way to express themselves. And I have to make it an ongoing thing because I can lapse into being at whatever level I am, become complacent, and when I do, I don't stay in the same place. I start drifting backwards, and that's because of the entropy of the universe. It just makes me drift backwards and never just lets me stay in the same place, and it's a continuous process, and it's not always easy. It takes some effort. We spend 30 minutes every morning in prayer and meditation, committed to that, plus some time throughout the day that, you know, we try to share, but if I don't do those 30 minutes, and it's such a tremendous thing in building this relationship with Patricia, to share those times and to share that with each other.
Well, what you just said reminds me of that great
quote from the Urantia book that says, learn to be faithful to the kingdom even in times of peace and prosperity. And
yes.
Angels of your supervision to lead you into troublous ways as a loving discipline designed to save your ease drifting soul.
That's it. Oh, yes.
We can so easily get complacent with our spiritual growth, you know?
Yes. And
the
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm going to have to take off too because I've got to get that. I've got that other book signing, and I've enjoyed this so much. I know Patricia did too, but she had to leave a few minutes earlier.
Well, it was so great to have you.
And we hope you'll come back when you can stay longer, because this is a topic that we really do want to be able to get into more depth, especially in the how to really deal with challenges that all relationships have, and what are some of the ways that we can deal with them more effectively and that actually enhance our loving passion towards our mate.
Right. You know, one of the things I wanted to mention, I'm going to mention my book and put a plug in for that, of course. It's on spiritual engineering, spiritual-engineering.com, spiritual-engineering.com. It's available through Amazon. And I'd love to talk, you know, we really would like to spend some more time, because some of the things that we talk about in relationships with the other people after we get it is we've mentioned congruency, the difference between helping and enabling. Enlightened forgiveness, how to forgive and not forget, the difference between truth and fact in relationships. There's all these things that are just very specific tools. You know, for a long time, I didn't know any of these, and these have been not just the learning on my part, but from the Urantia book, from 12-step programs, from psychology and everything, and it's all built into a step-by-step process because, as you were mentioning, congruency in a relationship and integrity and things like this are just so important, and we have to be not only aware of them, we need the tools on how to acquire and implement. These are all skills. They're all learnable skills. It's just like driving a car. We have to learn new habits and new ways of doing it.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's a long road to perfection, right?
It's a long way.
But you know what? The whole point is it doesn't have to be a meaningless journey. It can be full of purpose and meaning and value with other relationships, growing together all the way, learning from each other, loving each other, helping each other. It's a journey we make together, and that's the whole point. And so thank you for this important work, Thomas. And, you know, we have a guy on the board, Dave Tucker, who said he loves your book so much he's giving it to everybody.
Oh,
so,
great.
And I love a book like that, too. I just think it is full of practical wisdom and things that will help people immediately help them have a better life. And what could be better than that? So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having us. We'd love to come back. I apologize for not having more time, but we had these two commitments, but just love the work you all are doing too. And the thing is, that's what Patricia and I say, if we can help one person change their life a little bit, or one person find this God within, man, it's been a fantastic, you know, achievement, because everybody's got it, and we just try to help people realize and experience this fact that God lives inside of each one of us and is there to help us and give us energy and give us direction. It's all there right now.
Everything we need.
Everything. Thanks,
yeah.
And God bless. Love you both.
Love you.
Thanks.
Too. God bless you.
Love you too.
Have
Bye-bye.
A great weekend. Bye-bye. Well,
what
that
a dynamic couple they are. And I mean, they're just such an example of what they teach. You know, they really live what they teach. So
those of our listeners who haven't met Patricia and Thomas, I wish you could. I wish you could see the two of them together, because they're just such amazing lovebirds. And they just spread good cheer wherever they go. You can't help but feel really happy in their presence, don't you think?
Oh, yes. They're just lit from within. They are so enthralled with what they're doing, and their work is so meaningful, and they're so engaged in it and in love with it and in love with each other.
Patricia, obviously you can tell by her accent, she's Spanish speaking, and she has that great passion and open heart. And I love to just be with her in a group of people because she just gets so passionate and starts speaking passionately. And Thomas is ever the engineer, and they both just have this wonderful sparkle in their eye, and they're really living their truth, and that's inspiring to me. Deeply inspiring. So
well, one
so
of the things that I was hoping that they would have time to get into, which I'm afraid they didn't because they had to get going, but maybe we can talk about it and discuss, you know, what we've been able to observe. But that is that, you know, how to bring that kind of energy out in a relationship that you're committed, deeply committed to, where the one party in the relationship doesn't seem to have as much experience being loving and forgiving and tolerant, and how we can, having only just one person in the relationship, be aware of the type of dynamic it takes to turn an argument into a discussion, or to turn a crisis into a classroom. You know, what kinds of things can we do within our relationships, within our primary relationships with family and loved ones, to make that a positive growing experience rather than one where we're constantly worried about that kind of criticism or undermining. And I know that you've practiced many of these kinds of things in your own family and in your own life. Do you feel compelled to share any particular examples?
You know, I want to first, because I think you bring up such a good point, Krislyn, and you know, we talk about drawing boundaries, and this is true. If somebody is truly toxic in our lives and we... you know, and we can not have that toxin, we can choose not to have it, then, you know, and sometimes we can keep a person at a level where they don't have such a toxic influence. That's important. That's important. But by the same token, we're here to do something. And as Jesus said, we've come to restore the self-esteem in those who have lost it and to restrain it in those who have it. And in both instances, it's an act of love and service. And it's not in, you know, it's all about how you do it. The how is so important. If you do it with love and patience and tolerance and kindness, you know, you can transmute even a toxic relationship. And, you know, any parent who's ever raised teenagers, you don't give up, though. That's the thing. You can't give up on the people you love, and that's what I've learned. And children, of course, that's a service ministry. It's like the Urantia book says. It's a lifelong service ministry that the wise child comes to appreciate. But I want to read this from the Jesus Papers because it deals exactly with what you're saying, and it's so vital. It's from his private ministry, the time he spent with the two Indians, Gonad and Ganad, in the Mediterranean, and the authors of the book tell us this was his private ministry as opposed to his public ministry. I cherish these parts of the book more than I can even express. They mean so much to me, and these words of Jesus are my lifeline. I will go back to them time and time again because the lessons are invaluable. And this is from part four, obviously, The Life and Teachings of Jesus, paper 130, On the Way to Rome, section 2 at Caesarea. One of the young men who worked with Jesus one day on the steering paddle became much interested in the words he dropped from hour to hour as they toiled in the shipyard. When Jesus intimated that the Father in heaven was interested in the welfare of his children on earth, this young Greek, Anaxand said, "If the gods are interested in me, then why do they not remove the cruel and unjust foreman of this workshop?" He was startled when Jesus replied, "Since you know the ways of kindness and value justice, perhaps the gods have brought this erring man near that you may lead him into this better way. Maybe you are the salt which is to make this brother more agreeable to all other men, that is, if you have not lost your savor. As it is, this man is your master in that his evil ways unfavorably influence you. Why not assert your mastery of evil by virtue of the power of goodness and thus become the master of all relations between the two of you? I predict that the good in you could overcome the evil in him if you give it a fair and living chance. There is no adventure in the course of mortal existence more enthralling than to enjoy the exhilaration of becoming the material life partner with spiritual energy and divine truth in one of their triumphant struggles with error and evil. It is a marvelous and transforming experience to become the living channel of spiritual light to the mortal who sits in spiritual darkness. If you are more blessed with truth than is this man, his need should challenge you. Surely you are not the coward who could stand by on the seashore and watch a fellow man who could not swim perish. How much more of value is this man's soul floundering in darkness compared to his body drowning in water?"
Wow, that really is a powerful metaphor, isn't it?
Oh, man.
Powerful parable.
You know, that, and I've thought about that so many times. I've thought how easily we give up on each other. Yes, we have to draw boundaries. There's no doubt about that. But we give up on each other so quickly. Sometimes it's almost like we're looking for a reason.
We're looking for their boundary-breaching opportunities to reject them.
Right. We just are looking for that, and once we find it, that's it. Their history, I don't have to deal with them anymore. I am done with them.
Right, and it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, sort of like, I knew something was going to go wrong, you know, or I was just waiting for that shoe to fall or for that person to make a mistake where I would be able to justify my suspicions that this person is not whole or not fit or not worthy. And compared to the concept of divine love, which is so profoundly gracious, first and foremost, it's gracious, because none of us would ever pass inspection from a spiritual point of view. And when we react to our fellows that way, or especially our significant others in relationship, where we can accept some really unacceptable response or reaction, And then sort of laugh with them about the ridiculousness of our taking ourselves or them so seriously. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I find that that's very frequently true in my relationships. You know,
and I've said this before, but it just occurs to me that most of the people we meet in our lives, most human beings are struggling. They're struggling with all of these things we've been talking about, with relationships, with family, with jobs, with, making ends meet, with finding the satisfactions of living, finding peace and joy and happiness, and self-respect, finding love, love of themselves and love of others. And often we can become, as Jesus said, the material life partner. We can be the person, the salt that restores their savor, if we haven't lost our own savor. And if we come from that point of view where, you know, and I think this is what Thomas and Patricia were getting at, where we're right with ourselves, we're comfortable in our own skin, we feel like we have something of value to give. And those of us who have read this revelation for so long, and I know you know what I'm talking about, you've been given a great gift. Oh, my gosh. It's such a great gift. You've been restored. You've been restored to a sense of fearlessness about life. You're not afraid to live, and you're not afraid to die anymore. You understand how loved you are by the universe, by your Creator, by all of His agencies, by our Sovereign, our Master, Michael, Jesus. You understand how much has been given you. And you can really give something back now. Whether it be directly from the book and its teachings or directly just from what you've been given in your heart and mind and the peace that's in your own soul, and you can give that back to some struggling mortal. Some mortal, and I've had experiences, Krislyn, you mentioned, I've had experiences with people where they admitted to me that God doesn't love them, that God could never forgive them. And I asked God to give me these opportunities to minister to them. I asked directly for that chance because I feel so blessed to have these truths in my life.
Mm-hmm.
These truths pulled me back from the precipice of doubt and despair. And they gave my life purpose and meaning and value. They have been the single most important thing that's ever happened to me. Next to being a parent, there is no experience I've ever had in my life or encountered as meaningful and important as the words in this book, for Pete's sake. Nothing has ever empowered me like this. And to be able to look, and I will tell you a story, and I've told this, you know this story. I prayed I prayed to the angels that they would bring troubled mortals into my life because I felt confident that I could cheer them up and help them feel better about themselves. I really did, and I told them, I identified that. I've always been good at that, I told them. I've been good at that. So there you go. If you know somebody that needs to be cheered up, send them to me. And, man, they took me up on that. And the next person that, and you know exactly what I'm talking about because you hung your shingle out on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, I will minister to you. Let me know how I can help. And people took you up on it.
Right. Almost immediately.
Almost immediately. You hold your hand up. Our dear friend Andrea says, yeah, I held my hand up and wow. I can't believe what happened when I held my hand up. Choose me, I'll help. Help, use me. And the very next person that walked through my door, I had a business, was a Vietnam vet who was so battered and so broken. This poor soul, oh my gosh, I think about him still. He, I think I've even told this story on air, but it bears repeating. He had gone to Vietnam. He was an intelligence officer. He was working for the DEA at the time because a lot of the Vietnam vet, you know, a lot of the soldiers in Vietnam were abusing drugs and alcohol. Well, it was just such a terrible position they were in. I mean, it was, you know, war is horrible. We can't even imagine the horrors of war unless we've been there. And they were faced with it head on. And they had a variety of ways to get drugs and alcohol, and they were abusing them. He was sent over there to figure all of this out. And he was about 29 years old when they sent him. He weighed 180 pounds. He was a strapping, solid young man. And obviously a patriot. And he got captured by the enemy. He was held in a cage in the jungle for 5 years. Now, this is all stuff that came out over a long period of time. I mean, when he walked into my store, he weighed 120 pounds. He looked like a skeleton with skin on it. He could barely walk. He walked with a cane. He looked like he was 70 years old and he was only 50. I was about 30 at the time. Maybe a little older than that, in my early 30s. And he would call me up. I knew that he was somebody the angels wanted me to love and to help. And he would call me up at my store, and he would say, he always called me by my last name. He always called me Thompson. He'd say, "Thompson, I need your help. Grab a bottle of vodka and come over." Now, I've got to tell you, I didn't judge his alcohol addiction. I did not ever judge it. I would stop by the liquor store and get a bottle of vodka, and I'd go over to his house. And he would pour himself a shot and take a drink and start to talk. And in the course of these meetings that we had, many things came out. And that's when I learned that he was taken prisoner. He was held in a cage in Vietnam for 5 years. And he would tell me as much as he could, and then he'd have to stop. Well, over a course of time, he told me that he was held in this cage. They tortured him. They tortured him. Oh, man, they just were brutal to him. They wanted to get information out of him. They pulled his fingernails out. They pulled his teeth out. They shot him in the shin so that he couldn't escape. And that's why he walked with a cane. His shin bone was just absolutely shattered. And of course, they marginally fixed it, but, I mean, it made him a cripple. They made him watch as they shot his friend. They did everything, unimaginable horrors, torture to him. And he shared these horrors, these horrific things that one human being can do to another. But that was not why he believed God couldn't forgive him. And after a series of these meetings with him, the horrific dark secret came out. And he told me, he said, "I know God can't forgive me for the things I've done." And I said, "Michael, why would you believe that?" And he knew how I felt about the Orangia book. He knew me spiritually very much. I was a minister to him. He knew that. He knew that. There was no pretense otherwise. I said, "Michael, why would you believe that your Heavenly Father can't forgive you? What could you possibly have done?" And he said, "Well," he said, "when I was in Nam," he said, I was when they captured me, right before they captured me, he said, "I was in a trench," and he said, "I came on a Viet Cong dead to rights." He said, "We had each other in our sights, but I had one up on him." And he said he knew that I could kill him. And he said he pulled out his wallet, and he was begging me not to. And he said, he showed me a picture of his wife and his kids. And he was pleading for his life. And I killed him anyway. And he said, "And I know." He said, "My capture, all the torture I went through, it was all punishment for that. God cannot forgive me for that. God will never forgive me for it. I took this man's life, and I didn't have to." And I said, do you really believe he didn't have to take his life, Michael? Do you really believe that? Or did you believe that, you know, if you didn't kill him, he was probably going to kill you? And he said, well, you know, he said, in that moment, yes, I did believe that if I let him live, he was probably going to kill me, and I wouldn't get to see my own wife and my own children again. And, you know, as it turned out, because he was in this cage for 5 years, his own wife and children thought he was dead, and they declared him missing in action, presumed dead. When they finally found him and brought him home, they had to carry him out of the plane on a Stryker frame. In other words, he could not walk of his own power. He couldn't even stand up. On the plane home, he found out that both of his parents had died. He found out that his wife had divorced him, and essentially his children had grown up. He had two daughters. They carried him out of the plane on a Stryker frame so that he could be upright, and Berkeley students came down and threw rotten eggs at him.
Hmm.
And this, he endured all of this. Now, this is like, you know, what can you say to this man? And I told him, I said, and to me, Crystal, and honestly, the greatest privilege of my life is to be able to minister to this human being. And I said, Michael, as God is my witness, you are forgiven. Believe me, God understands the human condition better than even we do. And he knows our human frailties better than we do. And I think, Michael, even the man, the Vietnam man who showed you his wife and children, understands why you had to do that, and probably would admit to you that he would have done the same thing in your position.
Mm-hmm.
And even he, I will submit to you that even he has forgiven you. And I know God has. And I know God loves you. I know that. And I know you are forgiven. And I know you are a beloved child of God.
And if you could hear his story and accept him and forgive him yourself, I mean, not to reject him for that story, how much more would God understand him than we could?
Absolutely.
You know, those of us who are there to minister to them when they feel that you can understand and you can accept, then
right,
maybe slowly can learn to believe that God forgives.
Now imagine, you know, Jesus saying, judge not lest you be judged, for by the spirit with which you judge, so shall you be judged. If I had judged him in that moment and said, Michael, you jerk, how could you do that? Which is what he feared the most, right? Why he wouldn't tell anybody. Why he
mm-hmm.
couldn't tell anybody that story.
Mm-hmm.
Because he so feared that judgment. And he so feared hearing from another human being, you're right, you're going to hell.
You're right, that is unforgivable. I could never live with you again. I could never be married to someone who did something like that.
Right.
And that sort of brings us around to the topic for today, you know, about developing these tools and skills to allow us to have not just healthy relationships, but incredible relationships. You know, I know that I don't want to settle for a relationship that just survives, that just does not end in divorce. I know that I want a relationship that far surpasses good enough. You know, I want a relationship with someone who I consider my very best friend. And part of the process of getting to that level of relationship trust between men and women seems to me to be that type of gracious forgiveness. That,
right.
that we invest the time necessary and that we give our spouse or our mate the benefit of the doubt and that we genuinely care about what traumas or what life experiences they've gone through to become what they are or who they are today.
You know,
there are some people that we're in relationship with who are less forthcoming than others. Some people find it very easy to talk about the painful experiences in their lives, and some find it really, really almost impossible. So
well,
what
yeah.
can we do to draw out that trust from our mate?
Well, one thing is we can suspend our judgments. and I think that, you know, we can have meaningful relationships, deeply meaningful relationships with more than just our partner.
Oh, yeah.
We can obviously have a truly intimate relationship, a sexual relationship, and it's a relationship obviously on a much deeper level than you can have with everybody else. And it's special in that respect, but every relationship is special. And we can have meaningful relationships with so many people, but we have to be willing not to judge them. And to really try to see them as God sees them and to look for what God looks for in them, that heroic human being, that unselfish person who would lay down their life for someone else, that nobility that's inherent in a human because he's the Son of God. And allow that to show itself. Give them a safe place. Create a safe place, which for me a safe place is a place, you know, why do you suppose the greatest fear of all is the fear of speaking in public?
Well, probably because
so
people are terrified of being rejected by, or being, you know, dismissed out of hand. By people they don't know.
And being judged.
Mm-hmm.
Being found wanting, not good enough, unworthy. So that if we suspend that notion of, you know, up front, let people know, hey, I'm not going to make this judgment about you. I do not find you unworthy. I find you worthy.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I'm willing to spend time with you. And so, you know, open up. And I have found that when you do communicate, it's like I know I've told you before, one of my favorite sayings is from Zig Ziglar. He says, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so when you communicate how much you care, they become willing to open up to you. And when they become willing to open up to you, they show you the most beautiful things within themselves because they feel safe to be vulnerable.
And don't you find in your ministry, I know you just basically told us this a few minutes ago with your story, but that the joy of being accepted as a someone's minister, as someone's confessor, or as the person someone trusts to unburden themselves, that you feel deeply, deeply moved by the awesome trust that this other being has bestowed upon you to love them in their most vulnerable moments. There's something profoundly good and true and beautiful in that experience.
Well, you know, Krystalyn, it just doesn't get any better than that, I don't think. It's like Jesus told the guy in the shipyard. You know, there is no experience more enthralling. None. Not one experience more enthralling than to be a beacon of light for somebody who's in the darkness. I mean, I've experienced the whole gamut of human emotions, like most of us have. And I can say, without doubt, there is nothing more enthralling than this. To be able to, you know, and Jesus said it so many ways. It's like when they restored the lost child to his home, and he said to Gana, didn't we not supremely enjoy this ministry of restoring the lost child to his home, mother? Mm-hmm. And you know, most humans are like the lost child. They suffer in sorrow and in darkness when in reality they're just a little way from home.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful metaphor, such a great illustration.
Yeah.
You know, people travel the whole world and seek their whole lives to find that spark of God which lies within their own souls.
Right. And we can help them find that. We can help them be at peace with themselves and know that they are, you know, irreplaceable in infinity without duplicate in eternity. We've been given that gift, and we can give that gift.
And now turn that around to the kind of relationship we have with our mates, the kind of devoted friendship and loyalty and love and compassion that we can show to our own significant other.
Yeah.
For some reason, it can be more difficult to love that member of our own family than sometimes someone who was a total stranger minutes before.
You know, I think
the reason
people divorce, for instance, and the reason they don't have a meaningful relationship, it never gets to that level, because it started out superficial. It starts out often in lust and in infatuation, and it never gets any deeper than that. So that when real trouble comes, it's not strong enough to withstand it. And when you really love somebody, you love them for the right reasons. It's not because they're pretty or because they're rich. It's because they're good. And you know in your heart they're good. They want to be, they're motivated by good things. They're kind. They try to be understanding. Let's say they try to be good. They try. They work at it. You know, they care about people. They, you know, when the chips are down, they're willing to hunker down with you and go through the storm. And in the end, when a storm comes into a relationship, that's what keeps you together. Because you say, you know, darn, I'm really mad at you right now, but I know that your motives are good and your intentions are good, and I know you mean to do the right thing. And I'm going to hang in here with you because I do know that about you. And I do love you. And I couldn't hurt you. I could never hurt you because I love you. It would hurt me to see you hurt because I love you. That's true love. True love doesn't give up on people.
I think that really is the key right there. The true love doesn't give up on people. Because I don't care who you are and how much time you've invested in your own spiritual growth and development, there is going to come a day and there is going to come a time when you lose your cool. And when you don't behave in the way that you're capable of. Because I don't know about you, Paula, but I don't know very many people who can maintain their sanctimonious virtues 24/7, 365 days a year. We all have moments when we lose it, when we behave in ways that make us feel ashamed. Maybe it wasn't quite as dramatic as the experience that your friend had in Vietnam. But we kind of all have our own little wars that we're dealing with in the world. You know, sometimes it might be something as simple as the tech person with AT&T. Or, you know, someone who's trying to help you solve a problem and they're not finding the solution fast enough, and it's just taking up maybe 1 or 2 hours of your workday too many. You know, some of my friends here who've been following my daily ups and downs heard recently that I had a really challenging experience with tech support. You know, where I was dealing with someone who probably didn't understand the language very well, who didn't seem to understand a question that was a relatively straightforward problem. And not only was he unable to solve my problem, but he made it much, much worse. It took us almost a solid week to undo the damage that he did trying to repair a system that wasn't even broken.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, we were trying to find out a password that we no longer could find, or that no one remembered, or it hadn't been written down. And instead of, you know, getting my stepdaughter's new computer up and running on our Wi-Fi, we ended up one by one losing all of the services that were part of our AT&T bundle.
Oh, my.
You know, first, the Internet went down, and then the Wi-Fi went down, and then the television went down, and then our TiVo got completely cleared of all of the programs we had saved for the last 6 months. And in each of those situations, in and of themselves, it was not that big of a deal. But when collectively gathered in the aggregate, it became more and more and more of a serious frustration.
You want to cry after a while. I have actually, you know, broke down on some of these guys when they have been just not, you know, the frustration level builds to the point where you just, the customer service is gone, but that's another bugaboo.
Right.
Another pet peeve. Anyway,
but you know what?
We're down to two minutes, and I don't know if you want to mention who we got coming up or not.
Well, let me just really quickly conclude and see how this ties in, and that is that at the point where I had finally lost my cool, I didn't have the satisfaction, and here I find it very odd that the satisfaction for me would have been being able to yell at this person, which I wasn't able to do because I was communicating via chat. So the only recourse I had was the all caps function, where, you know, 3 or 4 sentences in a row were just all capital letters with several exclamation points at the end before I finally just terminated the call. And right at that moment, my husband walked in the door from work. And he, I could yell at. And so poor Steve got, you know, I just unloaded 3.5 hours worth of frustration on him and just started yelling at him and how this was all his fault and all of the completely irrational reasons why I was justified in blaming him. And when I was done and subdued and mollified and realized just how horrible I had been to him, completely innocent him, I realized there was something else really special about a relationship where I could lose it in front of him and know that he would forgive me.
Yes.
And that know that he would graciously accept all this blame that was not his and love me in spite of it. And that was a really beautiful feeling.
Yeah, that is a beautiful feeling. And you know what? That's what we provide for each other in those wonderful, intimate relationships. We provide a place where we can act like an angry two-year-old and still be loved and forgiven. So, well, we are out of time right now.
Okay, and well, I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about the upcoming shows, but go ahead.
We've got what? We've got your ranch of history?
There's still some uncertainty about what the date is that they'll be coming on, but we'll be talking with the Urantia Historical Society and hopefully with another couple who have done some remarkable work with kids in providing them with spiritual perspectives and ways to handle material problems. We have a few more authors of books that are relevant to the deepening the personal relationship with God. And we hope to do a series in the very near future on this topic we just barely touched on today, which was how to have a real soulmate kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
How to find and to keep and to maintain really fabulous relationships in your life.
Yeah. So there's always a lot we can talk about, obviously. And what I would like to do, too, is to we've got this conference coming up next summer, which is about service, essentially, and doing something, acting globally and growing cosmically. And so I would love for us also to do a series on what people have done, extraordinary things people have done. And so I'm really committed to trying to get some guests. You know, you had pointed out to me the guy that actually was able to change so many African villages by just going and drilling a well and just providing a basic need, clean water, and how much disease and death and sorrow was alleviated just by doing one thing, drilling a clean well for people of a village to have water. Those are the kinds of things that I would like to, you know, if we can get somebody from his organization to come on and talk to us, I think that would be really great.
Well, it would be a fitting end to the month because September is their annual funding drive, where they ask people to everybody who has a birthday in September, they ask them to offer the option to their friends and family instead of giving them birthday gifts to donate $20 to Charity Water. And they have a system set up whereby anybody can do that by going onto their site at charitywater.com or .org. I think I can't remember now which it is, but Charity Water and Scott Harrison is his name, and get all of your friends to buy a $20 bottle of water to support providing water for those people in other countries that have no access to clean water. It's a wonderful project.
It is.
So, okay, I'll try. I'll try again to see if we can't get someone from that organization to come on the air with us soon.
We can't get Scott, but maybe we can get somebody in his organization that's really passionate about it and could talk to us about it. That would be great. And the other one is Hugh that I met at the Parliament of the World's Religions, who has developed a program to end world poverty.
That's really an amazing story too.
Yeah, a 15-year-old kid went on a field trip and stayed with some of the poorest people in the world. They lived on a trash heap, and they eked out an existence by picking trash. And he decided nobody in the world should have to live like this, and he went on a very passionate mission to end poverty, and got the help of people like Bono and U2. This amazing story. So that's what I'd like to focus on. But in the meantime, we'll just keep bringing what we can and do the best we can to make it interesting and inspiring.
And we also heard back just this last week from another author we wrote to, who's with the Emergent Church movement, who would very much like to come on the air with us.
Right.
And again, we're hoping to bring the more information about the amazing work that's being done by the Urantia Historical Society.
Yes.
So thanks again for being with us for another Saturday afternoon and Saturday morning chat. And we hope you'll join us again next week.
Thank you, my dear friend.
Thank you. It was a pleasure as always.
Have a great weekend. Thank you. You too.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.